the defense budget does have exploded, no question. The one thing that's not mentioned, that should be mentioned, is the interest on the national debt is more than half of the defense that we spend. It's up to almost $430 billion now in interest. It's one of the largest budget items. I think it's number four in the list, and it's growing, and as interest rates tick up, that number is going to explode on the interest, just to be clear. So when there's a finite amount of money, Sandy is correct again, that when we start doing what we're doing by increasing the amount of dollars that we're throwing out there, that does increase inflation. That has that may effectively a tax on all Americans for the items that we purchase. That being the case, back to the Russia-Ukraine situation, to Sandy's point, yes, we did sign an agreement back in November with Ukraine, but obviously, Sandy, you would agree to this as well, you know, in the early 90s, back in the 1992, I think the Budapest agreement was that we would do assurances, not a guaranteed assurance, which is a huge difference, you know, from end of things, what we're going to do as the United States would do. That being the case, if you notice, Russia now, over the weekend, is doing military drills over some disputed Japanese islands now that was seized by Russia after the Second World War. And they have, I think they've moved a few thousand soldiers over there, and I'm not sure what their objective is. But at the end of the day, with what's going on in Ukraine, I don't see the harm of Poland lending some older MiG fighter jets just to try to help with, doing what we're doing over there. But, you know, as far as Ukraine, they have been actually, they've took back some of the suburbs outside the capital over the last few days. So that's a good thing. And now they're refocusing on the eastern part of Ukraine because Russia or Putin is now saying that we've accomplished our objective.
Is it safe to say that you are saying that America is not doing enough?
I think we could do a little bit more. I think we've done.
Like what?
We should allow Poland. I do think we should allow Poland to give the jets to Ukraine. I don't think that would be a bad thing. I think.
Now, Dave, hang on. Let's let Sandy respond. Sandy?
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, Dave, you and I agree on a more things than you think in the beginning of what's your recitation there. I do think the national debt and the size of the servicing of the national debt is going to be a serious problem. I think we should understand how much of that national debt we should lay at the feet of Donald Trump, the tax cut that occurred during his administration, and the amount of national debt which was incurred during that four-year term is astronomic, actually. And it was astronomic in terms of the comparison between the scale of that debt and the level of economic activity that didn't warrant a deficit. You know, we had some of our biggest boom years ever during Trump and some of the biggest deficits, which it runs contrary to logic. Normally, when you have a hot economy, you also get a surplus revenue in the federal account. So, national debt's a problem. With respect to the problem with Poland giving the MiGs, I think the problem has been in the past that Poland has asked that the MiGs essentially be replaced by U.S. fighter jets that would then be handed over to Poland to create a fighting force in their air force that could be more viable. And so that's the part where we've run into a bit of a block, which is whether the United States should facilitate the transfer of the MiGs by agreeing to sell U.S. fighter jets to Poland to replace those MiGs. And maybe it was even that we would give the fighter jets to Poland. And that's
It was give the jets to replace.
Yeah. So, So, I mean, I think it's more complicated than simply allowing Poland to give some MiGs to Ukraine for the purpose of supporting the no-fly zone over Ukraine. The other thing about the no-fly zone is I think most militarists would agree that Russia is not dominating the air over Ukraine through the use of manned aircraft, and that a no-fly zone would have little effect on the nature of the battle that's occurring on the ground. Most of what's happening that's through the air has lately been cruise missiles and rockets, which would not be affected materially by fighter jets. So it's complicated, but I sense in your voice, Dave, that you realize the need for moderation with respect to exactly how we support Ukraine. And you're right about that agreement back in 1992, and the Budapest Agreement, which was designed to cause Ukraine to give up its nuclear weaponry and to promise Ukraine in response to, or as a reward for that they would be protected. And that protection was to be accorded by Russia, the United States, and others. The reason we wanted them to give up those nuclear weapons so much at that point was that Ukraine was such a corrupt and inept government in its early stages that we had a great fear that nuclear weapons in the hands of Ukraine would very quickly get in the hands of terrorists around the world. So it was complicated in 1992, just like it's complicated right now.
So I would agree with most of what you said. I would just add, though, when Biden did call, Putin a butcher, we're essentially allowing the butcher of Ukraine still negotiate on our behalf, though, with Iran, which I think is overlooked and should be really dissected further, because at the end of the day, we're sanctioning Putin and we're saying all sorts of things, but at the same token, we're turning around and we're letting have the whole deal between Iran and Russia.
Let's dissect that one a little bit, Dave, because right now one of the countries that's been very slow to participate in the sanctioning of Ukraine has been Israel, and that's because Israel has forged quite a close relationship with Russia. And so I'm not sure that Russia negotiating on behalf of the parties with respect to Iran, to the extent they are, and I'm not certain that the United States isn't very actively involved in the negotiation, even if they're not sitting at the table. But in any case, Russia and Israel have forged quite a close relationship, and I'd be very surprised if Russia took a position with respect to Iran, which would be contrary to the interests of Israel. And I think that most of the people who are concerned about the negotiations with Iran are people who are very concerned about the defense of Israel.
There is a dynamic there between Israel and Russia, and it's due to the fact that there's still issues obviously going on in Syria. And you essentially have, you have outfits of people where I was telling Earl a couple weeks ago that you have weaponry coming in from Iran that's coming into, Syria and other places.
So Dave, with all due respect, to even be talking about Iran and as if Iran is going to somehow do what Russia is doing right now. There's nothing that will bear that out. And I think this continued conversation about, we've got to be, leery of Iran and what Iran is going to be doing is, to me, to be talking about it right now as if it somehow should be sharing the stage with what is happening in Ukraine, I think is a misnomer, man. Thank you very much for the call. Sandy, I get it. I think one of the things that people are leery of, and one of the, what Russia could be pushing for in Ukraine is to split Ukraine up like North Korea and South Korea. Do you think that that's something that could possibly happen? Is it, you think that's anything that Zelensky would be willing to see or to agree to? But it looks like that's something that could happen.
Well, I think a couple of weeks ago when I was talking, hopefully, about what that might be a peace achieved through a treaty negotiation, I did foresee that it was altogether likely that parts of the Donbass would potentially be split off. Luhansk and Donetsk would be potentially split off. And it looks like now the argument is how much. Luhansk and Donetsk are basically cities, and the Donbass is a region. And the amount of territory in the Donbass that is currently controlled by Russia is not as anywhere near as big as the entire Donbass region. It looks like what Putin is asking for is that the entire Donbass, as well as a land corridor that would include Mariupol all the way down to Crimea, would be partitioned off in a settlement such that Crimea, the land bridge that would follow the shoreline up to the Donbass, and then the Donbass would be partitioned off, and the Crimea would be recognized as part of Russia, and Luhansk and Donetsk would be recognized as separate republics. Exactly how that plays out, I'm not sure, but I'm pretty sure that ultimately Zelensky will agree to some land partitioning. The Crimea is a fait accompli. The ability of Ukraine to recover Crimea is pretty, the scenarios that would result in that are sort of far-fetched. So do I think that's likely? I do think that's likely. And I think that the Donbass could be separated, yes.
So Sandy, are we talking about those areas having natural resources, i.e. gas and those kinds of things, and oil and those kinds of things being a reason why Russia would want them? Do they have natural resources in those areas that would?
Well, Crimea is Sevastopol, which is a very important seaport that has always been important to Russia, even under the Romanovs. The Donbass, I believe, was a coal mining region. I'm not sure how important coal remains, but I think that was a primary resource there. Mariupol is a port on the Black Sea, so it has some value in that fashion. And it also creates a land bridge. I think that it's difficult for Crimea to be part of Russia if it's not connected with a land bridge to Russia.
Hey, Sandy, we've got to go to a break. When we come back, we'll continue the conversation. You're tuned into the Earl English Show. Sandy Williams is here. We'll be right back.